Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
Hello and welcome to the Earth 2 podcast, the show that navigates the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and explores the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics. I'm Steve Higgins.
And I'm David Steele. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. And welcome back once again, our pal Steve Higgins. Hello again, Steve.
Hello. Thank you again for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. Listeners, with Peter still in a mild state of recovery and not wanting to overdo things, Steve is stepping in this week to help us with Adventure Comics, just so that Peter can rest up as much as possible. There's always quite a lot of high drama and shouting in the Spectre stories, so we don't want Pete to lose his voice again after waiting so long for it to come back. So Steve has joined us once again. Superb. Without any further ado, this week we return, as you may have guessed from what I just said, to the pages of Adventure Comics and the adventures of the Golden Age Ghostly Guardian, the Spectre. This one's brutal, listeners, I do not mind saying. Some of these stories have been really quite vicious and nasty, and this one really takes the cake. But before we get to that, Steve's going to tell you about the cover.
Absolutely. So across the top, we have the Adventure Comics logo in a red banner with the DC bullet on the upper left hand and still only 20 cents on the upper right. Underneath the DC bullet, you have Adventure Comics number 434, August. And underneath the 20-cent mark, you have the Comics Code Authority stamp, seal of approval. Yes, this story was Comics Code approved somehow.
I don't believe it for a second.
Also, interesting to note that in between, up at the top, above Adventure Comics, it says Weird Adventure Comics.
Yeah.
In a very funky font. Yes. That I like. I like a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, that. The last issue had it too. Nice to see it. It'll be interesting to see how long it hangs about for. Things were very weird at DC Comics at this point, obviously, as I've said many times in the past.
Well, then the main image of the actual cover, in the foreground at the very bottom of the image, we have a person who is in a blue suit with a yellow and black striped tie, lying down on the ground. They're limp. It looks like they might be unconscious or maybe even worse. And they're being held aloft by this man-like creature that is wearing a red robe, like pajamas, and has its right hand gripping the lapels of the suit of the unconscious man. But the most interesting thing about this figure is that its head seems to be disconnecting from its body, and there seem to be springs or screws or something coming out of the neck as the head kind of lolls to the side. And what it is facing away from us and facing towards three mirrors, as in a dressing room. Here in the U.S., we'd have them in changing rooms of department stores if you're trying on clothes. And coming out of that mirror in the center is the Spectre reaching towards this creature that is holding this unconscious man. And we can see the Spectre then reflected on the left and right mirrors on each side. And it's coming right out at us, popping out at us, this image of the Spectre. Very powerful.
Yes, it's a brilliant cover. Sometimes when I look at it, I'm kind of caught by different things. First of all, you notice the Spectre, and then you look more closely and you see, you know, the figure in the dressing gown sort of holding the man. And it takes a second to notice that his head has sort of fallen off, or as you put it, has become disconnected. It's very interesting. The covers are sensational at this point. They really are. This is some of the best stuff we've done in the whole show. Adventure Comics 434, then, published on the 30th of April 1974. Listeners, if you're interested, that's part way between the final episode of the Doctor Who story, The Monster of Peladon, and the first episode of John Pertwee's final story, Planet of the Spiders. So there you go. Give it some historical context, and without any further ado, we shall leap into the story. As has become tradition, the story is introduced by a caption, very like the Stan Lee Presents boxes you got at the top of Marvel Comics in the 70s. We have a scene-setting caption that reminds us.
In the world of mortal men, he is Jim Corrigan, hard-boiled police detective. But in the twilight world where villains dwell, he is the Spectre, awesome avenger of evil, an earthbound ghost who punishes evil with a fearsome vengeance from beyond the grave. Tremble now as you peruse this fright-filled tale of the Nightmare Dummies and the Spectre.
Yes, it's an interesting opening image. Again, it doesn't kick off the story properly. It's an old-fashioned one, but it gives us a sense of what's going on. We see the Spectre emerging from Jim Corrigan's body and grabbing Gwen, who we've met over previous episodes, grabbing Gwen by the throat. And the Spectre is saying, "Now, vermin, taste the unearthly vengeance of the Spectre." And Gwen, as she's being choked, says,
Jim, please, how can you do this to me?"
And then in an insert panel, we get a close-up of Gwen looking horrified as she says,
"It's me, Gwen. I love you."
Gosh. And another small tiny caption gives us the credits for this issue.
Script, Michael Fleischer. Art, Frank Thorne and Jim Aparo. Script continuity, Russell Curley. And editor, Joe Orlando.
Wonderful. And the story properly begins in the first panel of page 2, where a caption sets the scene.
We begin our tale here on an open highway in late afternoon.
Yes, we see a truck or a van, something between a van and a truck, cutting along the open road. On the back, we can see the words Monarch Mannequin Company. Mannequin spelled M-A-N-N-I-K-I-N. And there's a little sort of crown logo, you know, Monarch, clearly. And from inside the truck, we hear a voice saying,
"Soon as we dump this load, Frank, we're heading for O'Brien's bar and getting ourselves a couple of nice cold beers. Yes, sir, when O'Brien pours that..."
"Yeah, Pete, I know," says the passenger, the guy we've heard talking as the driver, the guy who's been driving, an older-looking man, fair hair, green jacket, wearing a brown cap. And Frank, who's the passenger, has neat dark hair, black moustache, he's wearing a brown blouson-style leather jacket. Frank interrupts the driver saying, "But I promised Gloria I'd take her to a move," but he's cut off with this sort of rip sound. And then an insert panel, Frank says, "Did you hear that? What kind of noise was that?" Truck speeding along the next panel, and Pete replies,
"Sounded like it came from the back of the truck."
"Better pull over and let me have a look. If we busted one of them things, old man Monarch will have a fit over it."
And so...
the van has pulled up, Frank has gone round, and he's opened the back doors. He's looking in and he's thinking, "I knew we should have tied him down like I said in the first place. But try to tell Pete that and all you get is a big..." And then we see the view from inside the van looking out at Frank. Frank has now stepped up into the van. And we can see these very lifelike looking mannequins. It looks like they're all wrapped up in paper or bandages almost. Maybe that's just the way they've been transported. A number of shapes and sizes, adult and children figures. Frank looks around, looking like a mean-spirited Tony Stark, and thinks, "Looks okay in here. Little paper torn up maybe, but that's about..." And then, in the first panel of page 3, with a thwam, the doors of the van slam shut. We hear a, "Yeah!" And we cut back to Pete in the driver's seat, reacting to the sound, and he thinks,
"What, the bloody blue blazes?"
He gets out of the van, bearing a crowbar, walks round to the back of the van. He sees the doors are shut. He reaches up to try the doors, saying,
Frank? You okay in there? Frank?"
And then in the final panel of page 3, the doors of the van fly open, and we see 4 or 5 of the dummies, looking very lifelike indeed, moving forwards and reaching and grabbing towards Pete as they move out of the van. Pete cries,
"Huh? What the... They're alive! Help! Help! Help!"
The caption at the top of page 4 reads,
"Nightmares can be funny things. So scary when they have you in their grip. So silly once the night has ended. Poor Pete didn't have a chance against all those creatures, but he fought his nightmare as best he could. You have to give him credit for that."
Yeah, in the first panel, we can see that the mannequins, the dummies, are grabbing at Pete's clothes. He swings around with his crowbar, managing to shatter the head of one female dummy. And as he struggles, he says,
Please, I've got a wife and kids. Why are you..."
And the captioning continues.
"And as the nightmare ended, as one of those awful mannequins grabbed Pete's crowbar and smashed his brains into gory splinters, Pete remembered his childhood and prayed they wouldn't punish him for being late to school again."
Yes, very graphic panel when one male mannequin is bringing the crowbar down on Pete's head. We can see that Pete's managed to grab the arm of one of the other ones. He is putting up a fight. But then in the next insert panel, smaller insert panel, we can see Pete's body still on the ground, the mannequin standing over him, and the captioning continues.
"Isn't it funny the things you think of as your life's blood drains away?"
Yes, this is horrible. We see Pete's body still on the ground, the silhouetted forms of the mannequins standing around him, one of them still holding the crowbar. That panel is sort of inserted into a larger panel, which rounds out the whole of page 4, which is captioned.
Of course, the police arrive soon afterward. But what do policemen know of nightmares?
Yes, we see a police car, an ambulance, a number of uniformed officers looking down at Pete's body on the ground, the crowbar lying beside him, the mannequins all stretched out on the road as well. One older policeman wearing glasses says to a colleague,
"Whew, what do you make of this one, Chris?"
"It beats me. Frankly, I wish the weirdos of the world would save their fun and games for the night shift."
"What do you mean, weirdos? Who do you think did this?"
"How do I know who did it? Looks to me like the mannequins did it. It's not any fun being a store dummy, you know. First they..."
"Thanks a lot, Chris. You're a big help. Remind me to recommend you for the Detective of the Year award."
"Thanks. Say, you know who's going to just love this case, don't you?"
"Yeah, Corrigan. The weirder they are, the better that guy likes them. But he's out of town. Won't be back till tomorrow."
"That's okay. He'll still be here when he gets back. A little welcome home present." And while that conversation's been going on, we see Pete's body being attended to by an ambulance man and then carried away. A slow dissolve.
A full day passes without further incident. And then, in the sporting goods department of a suburban department store, just before closing...
Yes, we can see a mustachioed bald gentleman behind the counter, wearing a nice bow tie, dealing with a customer. Behind him, standing up on the counter, we can see some full-size dummies, one of whom is clutching a pair of skis, one of whom has a rifle with a sight on the top. And there's another one, obviously a kind of hunter, because he has a little cap, or what we would call over here a sort of body warmer, welly boots, and he's holding a shotgun in his hands. Yes. Chekhov's gun again, isn't it? The customer is saying,
"Give me two or three of those flatfish lures, will you? They..."
But then in the next panel, we see, rather alarmingly, the shotgun-bearing hunting dummy bringing the shotgun up to bear on the shop assistant and the customer. There is a click. The shop assistant looks terrified and says, "Look!" The customer says,
"Look at what? What's the..."
And he sees the dummy and exclaims,
"Oh, no!"
And the final panel, there is a massive blam, blam sound effect as the hunter dummy fires on customer and clerk. We hear their screams. Ah! And then we arrive, horror of horrors, at the top of page 6. Now this is terrifying. The caption there reads,
"Suddenly, as if in response to some horrifying secret signal, the other mannequins in the store spring from their pedestals and begin a ghastly orgy of nightmarish slaughter."
This is terrifying. It's obviously in the weddings and marriage department, because we see a number of dummies wearing wedding dresses leaping off their podiums and grabbing female customers. There's another mannequin done up as a groom, suddenly bearing a knife in the foreground. One woman, as she's grabbed by a bride mannequin, screams,
"Let go!"
And another one in the foreground, as her dummy grabs her by the throat, yells,
"Help!"
A slow dissolve.
Meanwhile, Detective Jim Corrigan relaxes in a taxicab on his way back from the airport. Or at least, he tries to.
Yes, this is a great shot of Jim in the back of the cab. And his cab driver, let's describe him. He's wearing a nice cab driver's uniform, jacket and hat. But he has thick, luxuriant, dark, curly hair, and a thick, luxuriant, dark moustache, and thick, luxuriant eyebrows, and big sideburns. He looks a proper character. And as the cab speeds along, we can see airplanes toing and froing in the background, some brilliant background detail, and the artwork. The cab driver is saying,
"I tell you, Mac, in all my born days, I've never seen anything like it anywhere."
Look, driver.
"I knew you wouldn't believe me, but it's true. The thing was huge, about the size of one of them..."
But Jim isn't really listening. He's thinking, "Oh, brother, if this guy doesn't..." But then we see, pulling up beside the cab, is a police car, and we can hear radio voice coming through saying,
"All units, calling all units. Car 814 reports multiple homicides at Hunt's department store. All units converge immediately. This is a call 91, signal red."
Jim Corrigan overhears this from his cab and thinks, "What?" And then in the next panel, the cab driver, who's still been wittering away, turns around saying,
"Like I was saying, this broad had..."
And he thinks,
"Huh? That guy I had back there. He's gone."
Yep, Corrigan has vanished. Caption for the top of page 7 reads,
"Gone? Well, not exactly."
And we see the spectre flying over the city thinking, "A taxi cab is all right for Jim Corrigan, but it is not a suitable conveyance for the spectre." And listeners, parental advisory, really, with this this episode. If you're reading along with your kids, this is proper horror comic stuff. Very, very unpleasant. We shift back to Hunt's department store. The caption for panel 2 of page 7 reads,
"Meanwhile, back at the department store, the rampage of horrifying butchery goes on and on and on."
And we see, well, we're basically at the scene that Steve described when he told us about the cover. We see a man in a dark suit being throttled by a male dummy in pyjamas and a dressing gown. The man sort of gurgles, uses the last of his strength to dislodge the head of the dummy. There's a crunch sound effect as it slightly becomes disconnected. And the caption for panel 3 reads,
"Even as a fearsome spectral avenger arrives eerily on the scene."
And in a panel that very closely replicates the cover, and I'm always delighted when this happens because I can get a tweet out of it, we see the spectre emerging through the mirror, and we see the dummy with its dislodged head holding a man by the throat, very much like we did in the cover. The spectre gestures towards the mannequin in the next panel, saying, "I see you have learned the secret of life, evil mannequin. Now, let the spectre teach you something of death." And with a whoosh, the mannequin goes up in flames as the spectre ignites him. The final panel of page 7 is a close shot of the spectre as he thinks, "Just dead plaster and lifeless steel. But before the night is through, there will be a human villain to taste my spectral vengeance."
So, David, is Lifeless Steel the name of your second solo album after you left Menswear? Is that
Yes, it's all about my middle-aged body falling apart in ways that I would have dreaded 20 years ago. That's exactly what it's about. It's very interesting. Look out for track 4 of side 2 where I talk about plucking my ear hair. So, we arrive at the top of page 8. A caption reads,
"Meanwhile, at the front of the store..."
Yes, this is grotesque. Might put this panel on the socials, I don't know. Lots of dead bodies littering the floor of the department store. Lots of mannequins draped about in unusual positions. A number of uniformed policemen and one plainclothes policeman are on the scene. The first uniformed cop says,
"All right, now what's... Holy Toledo! What's been going on in here? A damned war?"
A colleague of his says, "A war is right. Whole place looks like a cross between the Sharon Tate murders and the Battle of the Little Bighorn." The plainclothes cop turns to one of the other uniformed policemen and says,
"Hank, go call for a couple of meat wagons. We're gonna need 'em."
"Check," replies Hank. "Now, we've got another Pete and Hank here in this issue, just like we did with the first Spectre story. By my count, that's 3 Petes and 2 Hanks so far." There's been Pete the security van robber, Pete the evil hairdresser, and Pete the van driver. So we might have to start taking a drink, listeners, every time we meet someone called Pete or someone called Hank. Anyway, Hank runs off to call a couple of meat wagons. The plainclothes cop, standing over a dead body in the ground, he's speaking to one of the uniformed guys and he's saying,
"And make sure you get the names and addresses of all the eyeball witnesses to this thing. I want fingerprints, photographs, the whole damn circus. Just like in the movies."
And the uniformed cop says as he moves off, "Boy, the homicide boys are going to have a ball with this one." But we see in the final panel of page 8, a familiar figure in the foreground, as the plainclothes cop notices him and says,
"Detective Corrigan, how did you get here so fast? Didn't your plane just get in about 5 minutes ago?"
"Yeah, well, the plane got in a little early. I heard about this at the airport and took a cab right out here." Corrigan examining the head of one of the dummies there, the plainclothes guy continues,
"How do you make this one, Lieutenant? Freaky, ain't it? It must have took a whole army to wreck this joint like this."
"Pretty strange, all right. Anybody see it happen?"
"Oh, we got witnesses, all right. But they ain't no help. Hysterical, every last one of them."
Yeah, this conversation now taking place over an external shot of the Hunt department store in that 70s storytelling way that irritates the heck out of me. Plainclothes cop continues,
"Told us the mannequins in the store just came to life and started butchering everybody for no reason."
Next panel, Corrigan is kneeling down examining the feet of one of the dummies and he's saying, "Not a very encouraging lead, is it? But all the same, maybe I'd better go have a little talk with the people who manufacture these mannequins." And the insert panel shows the foot of the mannequin bearing the word Monarch in capital letters. A slow dissolve.
Meanwhile, in a cluttered workroom at the Monarch Mannequin Company,
we see an elderly gentleman, dungarees I would say, or overalls, shirt rolled up, mess of white hair, sort of visor around his head. I'm miming the visor for the benefit of our YouTube viewers. And we can see dummies in various sort of states of assembly, sitting around or hanging around him. He's perched on a stool working on one male figure. There's a bubbling vat in front of him. And as he paints the eyes in on this mannequin in front of him, this gentleman is saying, "Try not to be impatient, Harry. Just a few minutes more and you'll be all done." And my, my, won't you be a handsome devil? One look at you, and all the ladies will. But he's interrupted by a suited figure, a man, receding dark hair, horn-rim glasses, very neat moustache, looks a bit like Captain Peacock from Are You Being Served with glasses, if you can picture that. At this interruption, the elderly gentleman turns and says, "Huh, oh, hello, Mr. Marnax, sir." Man in a suit walks over, takes the elderly gentleman by the arm and says,
"Zeke, I'm afraid we're going to have a little talk about your work habits. I know how much you like to work back here all by yourself, making these mannequins one by one. But we can't afford to work by hand anymore. Times change. This is a modern factory now. Upstairs in the plant, we're mass-producing more mannequins in an hour than you can make by hand in 6 months. Why..."
"But, Mr. Monarch, you can't mass-produce mannequins like my mannequins, sir. Why, these mannequins are my friends. These mannequins are alive."
"Sure, sure, Zeke, I know. But we can't go on..."
And they're interrupted at this point. A very attractive lady in a pink top and short pink skirt arrives, saying, "Excuse me, Mr. Monarch, but there's a Lieutenant Corrigan here to see you. I tried to tell him that..."
"That's all right, Karen. I'll see him. We'll finish our talk later, Zeke."
And with that, Mr. Monarch and Karen take their exit, and Zeke whistles as he works, but he gives some very vicious side-eye as he watches Monarch and Karen leave. Caption for the first panel, page 11.
"Presently..."
And we're in Mr. Monarch's office. We can see the sign through his office window that reads Monarch Mannequins. So that saves us an exterior shot, I suppose, of the factory in two or three panels' time. Jim Corrigan is there in his overcoat in this well-appointed, lush-looking office. And Mr. Monarch is saying,
"And so I'm afraid I've already told the police all I know about those two drivers of ours who got killed yesterday, Lieutenant Corrigan. A horrible incident, just horrible."
Monarch takes a seat in panel two as Corrigan says, "I'm afraid it's happened again, Mr. Monarch. A wholesale slaughter at Hunt's department store, and witnesses claim your mannequins did it. They say the mannequins just came to life and started killing people."
Why, that's incredible.
"I know, but right now it's the only lead we've got. Mind if I look around a bit?"
"No, of course not. We'll do anything to help. Come on, I'll show you around the factory myself."
With that, Mr. Monarch stands up and opens the office door, leading the way outwards. A slow dissolve, the caption for the final panel, page 11.
"Soon."
And we see Mr. Monarch and Lieutenant Corrigan walking along the factory floor. We can see, again, mannequins and dummies in various states of assemblage being put together by some of the workers. Mr. Monarch is saying,
"This is the factory area where most of our mannequins are made. It's a more complex craft than most people realize. We use the most modern..."
"You say most of your mannequins are made here?"
"Well, yes. Old Zeke Borosovich still works at his own workroom, turning out mannequins by hand, one by one, just like they used to do it a half century ago."
And at this point, they're descending into the bowels of the factory, going down a flight of stairs, and Mr. Monarch continues,
"You've got to admire old Zeke's devotion, I guess, but in a competitive business like ours, it..."
"Would he mind if we stopped in there for a minute?" says Corrigan. Monarch replies,
"Ha, sure, he'd mind. He'd mind it when I come in there, but come on, it'll be all right."
We see a sign on the door that reads, "Ezekiel Borosovich, Mannequin Maker," and taped to the door. Corrigan and Mr. Monarch go in. Mr. Monarch says,
"This is Lieutenant Corrigan, Zeke. It seems that some people are accusing our mannequins of coming to life and murdering people."
Yes, we see that Zeke is still working, presumably on Harry. Zeke replies, "Really?
I was telling Lieutenant Corrigan that if any of our mannequins are guilty, they must be yours, Zeke. The way you fuss over them, some of them probably imagine they're actually human."
"How about that, Mr. Borosovich? You think your mannequins might suddenly come to life and start killing people for no reason?" Close-up of Zeke here, running out page 12. It looks very Joe Kubert to my eyes, doesn't it?
"Oh, yes, very much."
And Zeke replies to Jim, "Not for no reason, Mr. Corrigan, but they might kill if they got angry enough, and I wouldn't blame them for it neither. But how would you like to go through life the way they do? Always on display, no one taking them seriously, no one caring about their feelings after all."
"What did I tell you, Lieutenant? He..."
But Jim interrupts Mr. Monarch, saying, "Go on, Mr. Borosovich, please." And Zeke then points at his boss, saying, "No, I got nothing more to say. You're just like him, just like all the rest of them. You think you're so smart, but you ain't so smart. You ain't so damn smart." And Mr. Monarch, it must be said, looks a little bit frightened of Zeke at this point. A slow dissolve, caption for the next panel reads,
"Presently."
And it's another shot of Mr. Monarch and Corrigan walking along the corridor. But as the camera pulls out over the next three panels, we see that they're being watched by Zeke, who's cradling the head of a dummy. As they walk off down the corridor, Mr. Monarch is saying,
"Well, Lieutenant Corrigan, you've seen the whole shop. If there's anything else, I..."
"Just one more thing, Mr. Monarch. What exactly do you know about that fellow Borasovich?"
"Old Zeke? Harmless old coot, really. A little flaky, maybe. Been with the company since my dad founded the place. Maybe I ought to fire the old duffer, but I just haven't got it in me. In a way, you've got to feel sorry for old Zeke. Those mannequins are all he has. They're his whole life."
And that's when we see, as I've said already, the shot of Zeke looking down at the head of the mannequin that he's cradling. Interesting. Corrigan says in the final panel, page 13, "Does he often say stuff like that about the mannequins being angry and having a good reason for revenge?"
"Why, yes, I suppose he does. But it's harmless chatter. Zeke just thinks the rest of us should see his mannequins the way he sees them. As real people, with emotions and feelings."
First panel, page 14, they've left the building. Standing outside, we can see some seagulls or pigeons cutting about. Jim shakes hands with Mr. Monarch, saying, "Harmless chatter. I wonder. Thank you, Mr. Monarch. You've been very helpful."
"Don't mention it, Lieutenant. I just hope you fellows manage to get to the bottom of all this."
Jim moves off looking very, very deep in thought, rubbing his chin and thinking, "There's something weird about that." But his musings are interrupted by a screech of brakes. A red sports car pulls up, driven by none other than Gwen Sterling. Gwen sees Jim and cries,
"Jim! Jim! Wait up!"
Car pulls to halt, obviously. Corrigan says, "Gwen, how did..."
"I called the precinct. They said I might find you here. Oh, Jim, I've just got to talk to you. It's been weeks since I've seen you. Please, Jim, why can't we..."
"Because we can. That's why. And you know as well as I do why we can't. Don't you think it's painful for me too, being nothing but a... Now, for God's sake, get out of my life and leave me alone."
Jim, no. You don't..."
And as Gwen starts to cry, Corrigan turns his back on her and walks off, saying, "Yes, Gwen, I do. Now, please, I don't want to hurt you, but I'm a detective. I have work to do. Goodbye." The lieutenant captain tells us we're continued in the third page following. That's one interesting advert that concerns the reprint famous first edition of Sensation Comics number 1 and also for Tarzan Tabloid. So rush out and get your reprints of the first appearance of Wildcat and Mr. Terrific and come back and let us know. Top of page 15, we see Gwen standing outside Monarch's mannequins as Corrigan walks away. She blubs to herself and says quietly,
Goodbye, Jim.
But we see, standing behind her, is none other than Zeke Borasovich, who says, "Don't cry, miss. I just hate to see a pretty young girl cry."
Who are you?"
"Me? I'm just an old man, I guess. But I get pleasure out of helping folks in trouble. And in my workroom, I got just the thing to put everything right between you and that young Mr. Corrigan."
You do?"
says Gwen, as Zeke takes her by the arm and leads her off. A slow dissolve caption for panel 4 reads,
"Moments later..."
And we're back in Zeke's workroom. He's sat Gwen down, draped her jacket over the back of a chair, and he's saying, "Now, you sit right down here now while I make you a nice hot cup of tea. Just trust old Zeke. He'll have that Mr. Corrigan eaten out of your dainty little hand in no time at all." And another slow dissolve. A caption reads,
"Later that night in Jim Corrigan's apartment..."
Yes, we see Jim. He's listening to an LP. I can't really make out what it says. Maybe it's one of the LPs that he got six of for a dollar in one of those adverts a few weeks ago. Corrigan's thinking, "I was awfully hard on Gwen this afternoon," but as he's interrupted by a buzz, Jim now thinks, "The doorbell. Now who in blazes?" And as he answers the door on the final panel of page 15, we see a familiar figure. "Gwen! What on earth are you? Oh, hell, who cares? I'm glad you're here. Come on in." We see Gwen indeed looking very slinky and very sexy. We arrive at the top of page 16. Corrigan gestures round the room, saying, "Gwen, I'm sorry about the way I behaved this afternoon, but you more than anyone else know the horrible bind I'm in. Why, I'm not even a real person, for crying out loud. I'm a dead man." While Jim's been talking, Gwen, whose face is in shadow in the first panel, page 16, has reached into her handbag and produced what I can only call a sort of butcher's cleaver. And in the third panel, we see that she has lifted the cleaver up behind Jim as if to strike him. And indeed in panel 4, as Jim continues saying, "A lousy speck." There's a thwack sound effect as Gwen tries to bring the cleaver down on him, but of course, because he's a spook, it goes right through him and collides with a piece of the furniture. Jim, managing to keep it together admirably, says in the next panel, That was very foolish, my dear. Very foolish indeed. For to arouse the anger of Jim Corrigan is to tempt the wrath of the Spectre. And with that, the cleaver pulls itself out of the wall and flies towards a horrified-looking Gwen. The caption for the first panel on page 17 reads,
"It is a sight to chill the blood of mortal men, as the meat cleaver comes miraculously to life, whirling through the air with mighty blows, hacking off Gwen's arms, severing her legs from her body, smashing her skull in two."
Listeners, this is horrible, but it's very clear that this is not the real Gwen, because there's no blood or anything flying around. The captioning continues in the second panel, saying,
"Until finally, only a shattered corpse remains. The shattered corpse of..."
"A mannequin," observes the Spectre, who is now there. Corrigan has been replaced, looking down at what's left of the dummy as it falls to the ground. Spectre leans in closer, thinking, "Ingeniously fashioned in the likeness of Gwendolyn Starling, and sent here tonight to kill Jim Corrigan." Another slow dissolve.
"Meanwhile..."
Yes, we get a close-up of a very demonic-looking Zeke Borossovich as he's saying, "It's no use struggling, my pet. The ropes are far too tight." And as the camera pulls out for the next panel, we see that Gwen has been stripped her underwear, tied to a chair and gagged. She tries to speak, but her voice is muffled as Zeke continues, "But by all means, keep on trying. You look so fetching when you strain against the bonds. Soon, my luscious, my trusty Gwen Starling mannequin will have finished her work, and you will have your pesky Mr. Corrigan all to yourself, just as I promised." Page 17 runs out with a shot of Zeke standing in front of a number of his mannequins. And as we arrive at the top of page 18, Zeke continues, saying, "Unfortunately, however, he will be all chopped up into little..." But then he stops, because a familiar white and green figure has phased in through the ceiling. Zeke looks shocked and says, "What? Who are you?" "You are wise to tremble, old man. I am the Spectre. And when the Spectre comes calling, the lives of evil men are forfeit." "So you mean to kill old Zeke, do you? Well, you won't get away with it here. Old Zeke's got friends. Good friends." That Zeke gestures around, and the mannequins all round the outside of the room, it's quite a lot of them actually, about 10 or 12, start moving towards the Spectre. Zeke continues, "They may not seem like much to you, just paint and plaster and phony hair. But when old Zeke calls out to them, they listen. Yes, sir. These old mannequins will even kill for their old friend Zeke." Top of page 19, the Spectre isn't worried. He gestures and says, "Save your magic, old man. You will need it to ease your boredom during the eternity and perdition that awaits you." And as the Spectre gestures, there's a sound effect as all the mannequins dissolve and melt into just puddles of wax. Zeke moves over to Gwen, holding a knife to her throat, saying, "You think you're pretty smart, don't you? I bet you're proud of your fancy tricks. Well, I got tricks too. You get out of here and leave me be, or I'm going to slaughter this luscious little chickie here, just like she was an old hog." Spectre isn't having it. He says,
"Your mannequins have wrought evil deeds, Ezekiel. But now it is time for you to join them."
And there is a scream. Another slow dissolve.
The next day, in a large empty lot on the outskirts of the city.
Yes, we can see there's a bonfire going on by the looks of things. Can see a truck. Can't really make out the writing on the side. There's one word that says company. Must be removals or something like that. And there are three workmen, one in a green plaid shirt, who looks very much like the guy who was driving the truck at the start of the episode. Another guy in a little jacket, another guy who we don't really see too clearly. They're carrying these mannequins toward this bonfire. And the guy nearest the bonfire with his mannequins is saying,
"Why do you suppose old man Monarch is having us burn all these mannequins?"
One guy in a leather jacket replies, "That beats me. Maybe they're all last year's model or something." And we see another guy lifting a very familiar-looking dummy out of the back of the van as he says,
"Hey guys, look at this one. It's an old geezer mannequin. And get a load of his kisser. Got a look in his eyes like he just seen a ghost."
And we see that indeed this mannequin, if it is a mannequin, looks very much like Ezekiel Borossovich. We arrive at the top of page 20 now, as the guy in the green shirt lifts the dummy of the old man. He says,
"Soon as we... oops!"
But he cuts himself off, because with a clunk sound effect, we see that the dummy of the old man, his arm has snapped. Oof. And in panel 2, we see the workie in the green shirt and the cap hurling the dummy that looks very much like Zeke Borossovich into the fire. One of his colleagues says, "That's the last of them, ain't it, Ernie?"
"Yep. But let's wait around a minute.
I want to watch him burn.
We see in panel 3 that the bonfire is also being watched by Jim Corrigan and Gwen Sterling. Ernie's colleague replies, "How come?"
"I don't know. I just like to watch stuff burn, that's all."
We see Gwen and Jim walking off in the background as the conversation continues.
"Didn't you ever used to like to watch stuff burn when you was a kid?"
"Nah, I used to like water pistols when I was a kid. Did you ever have a Ouija, one of them little water pistols?"
"Yeah, I had one. That's what they called them, all right? Ouijis."
And the final panel shows the dummy that once was Zeke Borosovich dissolving and melting in the flames as a small caption reads,
The end.
Well then, that was utterly horrific, wasn't it?
It was indeed. Goodness. This gruesome, gruesome stuff, but incredible.
I'm stunned that this was approved by the code, quite frankly, because it's so, I mean, man gets beaten to death by crowbar, people getting shot at close range, older women being strangled by bride dummies, that man getting strangled and then knocking the head off, and it's just like, it's vile. God. I mean, the stories we've had so far with the Spectre, this is the fourth one that we've done. They've all been quite violent, but to me this seems a little bit more, it's not very fantasy violent, is it?
No, it's pretty graphic. In particular, the one that really gets me is on page 17 when Gwen gets chopped up with the cleaver, because at that point,
yes,
we kind of think that that's actually Gwen.
Yes.
But then luckily, very next panel, we see she's a mannequin. But just for like a split second, I can imagine some kid coming across this comic and being like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Corrigan's chopping up his own girlfriend with a cleaver? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I mean, for all we know, this is the real Gwen that's been possessed or had been hypnotized by Zeke or something and is, you know, acting under his instruction. Yeah, you're right. It's a good thing that the reveal comes so quickly, but it's horrible. I mean, the obvious thing to reference is the Autons in Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
Shot window dummies coming to life and attacking people. It's very Spearhead from Space. It's very Rose. There was also an episode of the Kolchak the Night Stalker series called the Trevi Collection, which also had mannequin dummies coming to life, but that wasn't actually shown until the 24th of January, 1975. So, is it possible that Rudolf Borchet, who wrote that episode of Night Stalker, had read this issue of The Spectre? We'll probably never know.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if Michael Fleischer saw Spearhead in Space somehow.
I don't know.
It would have been transmitted in the UK, what, like 70, 71? I forget.
Yeah, January 1970.
Okay, and so this was obviously after that, but I don't know that it would have made it to the US yet.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the first attempt to kind of sell Doctor Who and its syndication was done with some of the Pertwee stuff, and that's how we've got colour recordings of some of the Johnsy stories, because the Beeb had wiped and they re-imported the 525 Line Masters, etc., blah, 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 if that makes any sense. I'm not sure. It's always a very effective sort of device. And, I mean, look at the first panel of page 8 when there's just dead bodies strewn everywhere and absolute carnage. The contrast between this and the regular sort of superhero stuff that we do is is massive. It's very unpleasant to behold in places. This is the longest story that we've done, running to the full length of the comic, 20 pages. The other ones we've done so far previously have been 13 pages. And I think, you know, it could have been condensed down easily enough, but one thing that I do like is that the layouts are quite imaginative in this one. Like page 7, as the Spectre arrives through the mirror, the way that that's sort of structured, the way that the odd panel shapes, they add to the sort of violent discord sort of sense, if you like. I sound very pretentious when I say that. If this had just been done in a normal sort of like square grid, I don't think page 7 for 1 would have been very effective. The same diagonal split for the violence in page 5 and the use of sort of descending sort of insert panels as Pete gets battered by the crowbar on page 4. It's all very interesting.
When you pointed out when you were doing the descriptions, the panels on page 13 of Mr. Monarch and Corrigan walking down the hall and how it kind of gradually zooms out in that.
Yeah.
That's a very inventive way of doing that panel layout, and it's very effective. It's beautiful.
Obviously, we should go back to the credit captions. Art by Frank Thorne and Jim Aparo.
Yeah.
Because a couple of pages look more Jim Aparo than others. But as I said, there's a couple of panels, pages 2 and 3, and some of the shots of Zeke, it looks a bit more Joe Kubert than Jim Aparo. So presumably, those are the ones that Frank Thorne has done. I'm guessing one of them did layouts. But then you look at page 7, and that's very Jim Aparo. So I don't know if maybe the work was split between them, or one of them did layouts and one of them did inks. I'm not sure. It's maybe possible that Aparo drew the Spectre and the other stuff was was drawn by their guy. I'm not too sure. We'll have to see if we ever find out anything out about that. It's an interesting one. We're not really told how Zeke was able to manipulate the mannequins.
Right. I wondered that myself. I'm like, there's no indication of him being magic in any way, or like, you know, chuck a copy of the Necronomicon on the on a workbench somewhere or something so that it makes sense that he's got this ability to make these things come to life. But no, he's just like, I hate everybody that's not my mannequins and I want them to kill.
Yeah. And it's very strange the way it happens, because we're not really sure what he's trying to achieve. The fact that the van driver and his mate get killed right at the start when they're on their way, presumably on their way to take some of the mannequins to a shop where they can be used. Or maybe they're taking them back, I'm not sure. No, they must be taking them somewhere, because if we busted one of them, monocle of a fit. Yeah. You know, it's weird how they came to life and attacked the drivers that are kind of trying to take them to fulfill their purpose. And then, of course, you know, it all seems a bit self-sabotaging for Zeke to have them attack the customers. Those scenes of the punters being attacked are horrible. They are not the worst things that we will see in a Spectre story, though. There is some really bad stuff coming up in a couple of Spectre stories' time. Some really, really unpleasant stuff.
Another thing that I thought was kind of interesting, little funny note, I guess.
Right.
In the midst of the shop, the department store, just like massacre.
Yeah.
It begins with a mannequin carrying a shotgun, turning it against the customer and the clerk. Why was that shotgun loaded?
I know.
That seems like a bad idea.
Yes, asking for trouble, isn't it? That's crazy. That's a letter to head office right there, isn't it? My husband was shot because, oh man, that's horrible. Could the mannequin have been charged that it was able to just fire something out? I don't know, probably not. But oh no, you're right, that's insane.
Maybe the mannequin loaded it when nobody was looking. It like snuck over and grabbed a box of shells and then snuck back to its spot and loaded it really quick.
Yeah, maybe Borosovich snuck in and maybe it's part of his plan. I don't know, but you're right. That's asking for trouble, isn't it? I would hope to goodness that anybody else in the world that are selling guns and have them on dummies, that they're not loaded. That'd be terrifying.
As lax as America's gun laws are,
yes,
I think even in America, we would probably say, don't load the shotgun that the mannequin has that anybody could just walk up and grab. That's probably a bad idea.
Yes, very much so. I like the sort of slow burn aspect of Jim doing his investigating and talking to the boss and getting to meet Zeke and having some suspicions, and then Zeke deciding this guy's a threat. That was all pretty cool.
And, you know, in the end, even like the motive of he wants revenge because he's maybe getting fired or losing his job, or but even that, like Monarch says as they're walking away, I don't have it in my heart to like fire the guy. No, it's just like Monarch just like is evil.
Yeah.
That's pure and simple. We don't need the motive. Yeah. He just is evil.
Absolutely. You know, previously we have the Spectre chopping people up or burying them alive or whatever, melting them, but this one, he turns Zeke into a dummy. That's pretty dark, isn't it? Then the dummy gets hurled in a bonfire.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you love these mannequins so much, why don't you be one?
Yeah.
It's a very Twilight Zone-y kind of twist, or a you know, Outer Limits kind of...
Yeah, Tales of the Unexpected sort of thing, yeah. The last reveal is inexplicably the person's been also turned into a dummy. The continuation of the Jim and Gwen soap opera. Jim seems to be softening slightly. He seems to be less resistant to Gwen's advances. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because obviously they leave together at the end of the story. That's going to be an interesting one, because what future can their relationship have? And I don't think I've said this already. I find it quite distracting that she's called Gwen, because at this point in the early 70s, I'm still going to be thinking of Gwen Stacy, you know?
Oh, yeah. And not even just Gwen, but Gwen Sterling.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know? It's crazy. Maybe she's the Earth One equivalent of Gwen Stacy. But as we know, this is taking place in the Marvel Universe, because in the first Spectre story, poor Hank was reading the Daily Bugle. We must remember this and bear it in mind. Now, you said something in our prep about the cab driver looking like someone you knew.
Yes. So there was this magician that was on TV a lot in the late 70s, early 80s over in the US named Doug Hennings.
Right.
Was he popular at all in the UK? Did he cross over at all?
I don't recognise the name at all. We had obviously, we had our Ali Bongos and Paul Daniels by that point over here. I don't recognise him at all, no.
And so he had kind of long, brown, wavy hair, and he had a mustache much like this cab driver right. did. And it's definitely who I picture. He had kind of a light voice when he would deliver and he would do his tricks. It was very, very soft and very, very light.
Interesting.
I loved magic when I was a kid, so anytime there was a Doug Henning special, I was like, oh yeah, we gotta watch that. Yeah. And I liked him, for some reason, a lot more than David Copperfield, who was kind of the other big magician in the late sure. 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I'm aware of him, obviously, yeah.
Copperfield was always just kind of too schmaltzy, in a way, to me. Like, ooh, look what I can do. Whereas Doug Henning's was like, it's fanciful, and he was okay with it all being light and... But yeah, this guy, Doug Hennings, is who I thought of instantly.
I see. Interesting. Listeners, which TV magicians do you remember from your childhood that have looked like characters that we've done in stories? Write in and let us know. Magicians aside, I think we just summed this one up as being really, really quite unpleasant.
Absolutely. It was gruesome. It was incredible. It was really, really good, but it was very gruesome. And how this got approved by the Comics Code, I have no idea.
Yes, me neither. I mean, this is next level. This is, you know, the I keep coming back to the shotgun and the crowbar. It's just like, it's appalling, which is the perfect point for us probably to shift to the contemporary correspondence now and see what the readers at the time were thinking. Letters for this issue coming from Adventure Comics 437, which, if you're reading along at home, is the one with the big fish on the cover. So, Steve's going to read the first letter for us now.
Dear Joe, I really don't know what to say about Adventure Comics number 434. It was stunning. Now, Adventure is the kind of comic I could read all day. The Spectre is truly great. Mike Fleischer handles Spooky as a mystery character, like the Swamp Thing and the Phantom Stranger. And as a result, I can only say that this latest Spectre Resurrection is the only one I've really liked. Yes, the Spectre is doomed to haunt the pages of Adventure forever. I see no way out. I'm still unclear as to what Russell Carley does. It seems to me that he does something similar to art breakdowns or layouts, in that he visualizes how the panel will look, or rather the total effect of the page upon the eye, and directs the artist thusly. Is that correct? If so, he is a genius. Jim Aparo and Frank Thorne worked well together, and surprisingly so. Rather than a clashing melange of styles, as often happens with two artists of such different schools collaborating, they created a new style. It was excellent, too. The real reason I was so pleased with this issue was that it gave the story 20 entire pages, rather than following up with an anticlimactic Captain Fear story or some such thing. As a result of the 20 pages, much more time could be devoted to not only plot, but Jim's relationship with Gwen, which has been handled beautifully by Mike. May Gwen appear in every issue. But next issue, Aquaman swims in, and 20-page stories will have to go out. I mean, you must be kidding. The Spectre and Aquaman? Mike Fleischer and Steve Skeets? Jim Aparo and Marvelous Mike Grell? All in one issue? And that letter was written by Bob Rohde, Oak Brook, Illinois.
Is Oak Brook, Illinois anywhere near you or where you were at any point?
No. I grew up in southern Illinois, and Oak Brook is kind of up near Chicago, okay. Northern Illinois, very far away.
Well, there you go. Listen, you see, you know, when Steve's here, he can advise us on such points of American geography. It's all very interesting. Editorial response to Bob's letter then reads, "You've described Russell's role pretty accurately, except he aids in the plotting of the story also." All right. However, as of this issue, Russell is bidding us a fond farewell to return to his easel and palette. Michael will be taking on the entire task himself. Okay, that's fine.
Hmm.
The next letter then. Good morning, gentlemen. The Frank Thorne, Jim Aparo combination of issue 434 was indeed a pleasant surprise. As much as I am an avid admirer of Aparo's each and every classic, I find Frank Thorne's style amazingly similar. I am shocked that I'd never second-guessed such a superb combination. This is probably the best single issue of The Spectre to date. First, the script reads in the mind like the perfect narrator. No unnecessary skips, jumps, ads, or confused time sequences. High characterization of people even seemingly remotely connected to the storyline, and a pleasurable balance between normal day-to-day routine and the abnormal of the Spectre's supernatural realm. These are the qualities that make one learn how to spell Fleischer's name. Interesting. Second, a lady friend once told me that a man who carries a gun is looking for trouble. On the other hand, the Boy Scout motto says, be prepared. All of which brings us to the subject of violence in The Spectre. James Spectre Corrigan is not here to judge. He does not fanatically seek out anything his little heart desires. The Spectre defends, and defends well. When clumsy, ignorant, stumbling mankind is plagued by the parasites which kill it, then, and only then, does the Spectre enter into the picture, a perfect figure of death. When one is attacked, violence is a necessary reaction if stability is to be maintained. So let all those who feel that the Spectre acts mercilessly realise that few times indeed are reactions to atrocities anything but merciless. Few foes are talked to death. And that very wordy and syllable-full missive was from J. Edward Plank, Poughkeepsie, New York. And the editorial response is...
Thanks for your eloquent defence of the Spectre's philosophy. And we are eagerly awaiting your artistic verdict on the team of Eric Chua and Jim Aparo, which appears in this issue and the next. These two fill-in pencil jobs were necessary to allow Jim to have a short summer vacation and do Detective Comics.
Interesting. I think he was still doing Phantom Stranger at this point. Well, Phantom Stranger might have finished. I'm not too sure. Probably not. Anyway.
And so we come to the final letter of the letters page. And it begins. Dear Joe, with the sole exception of Spectre number 6, I have never read a Spectre story I enjoyed more than the one which appeared in Venture Comics 434. I am at last confident that the Ghostly Guardian is in good hands with the Fleischer, Aparo, Orlando team. None of your mystery mags, nor any of your competitors, have ever inspired the fear in me that the Nightmare Dummies and the Spectre did. The very thought of mannequins coming to life and butchering human beings as these did seems like something William Peter Blatty would have dreamed up. And that is by Scott Gibson from Sterling, Colorado.
Now, I'm going to show my ignorance here. I don't know who William Peter Blatty is, do you?
I have no idea.
Okay. Listeners, if you know who William Peter Blatty is, write in and let us know. No real editorial response to that one, but in the way of a tease for what's upcoming on the show, the next issue department caption reads, The Spectre haunts the Museum of Fear, and chapters 1 and 2 of the Seven Soldiers of Victory novel. Chapter 1 featuring the entire group is rendered by Dick Dillon and Tex Blaisdell, and chapter 2 spotlighting Green Arrow and Speedy, illustrated by Lee Elias. In the meantime, etc. So yes, listeners, that's something to look forward to. We haven't quite worked out when that'll be happening, but the Seven Soldiers of Victory, and hopefully some of the people who played them in the summer crossover last year, will be returning to the podcast very, very soon. Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you again. Always happy to lend a voice. And as you just said, if you need me in the Seven Soldiers episode to come back as Stripesy and do my horrible Luke Wilson impression, I'm in.
I'll send you the pages then so you can start practicing.
All right, Courtney.
That'll be fun. So yes, so we'll probably be asking Rager Gord to do Vigilante again. We'll be asking Brandon to do Sylvester again. We'll be asking Dan Butcher to play the Shining Knight again. We'll probably ask Chuck to play Green Arrow this time. Logan will be getting warmed up to do Speedy again. Yes, it could be it could be a lot of fun. Listeners, as usual at this point in the show, we will ask you to share your thoughts on the story. You can contact us, theearth2podcast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram, theearth2podcast. On Twitter, formerly known as X, or is it the other way around? It's podcast_earth2. Be sure to check out the socials. As usual, we'll have panel highlights, and I've managed to scrape a couple of foreign reprints and original pages story art to fling up there as well. If you're feeling generous, you can go to wherever it is you receive your podcasts and leave us a review. Maybe tell us what you think of Steve compared to Pete. Or you can go to our coffee page and buy Peter the price of a packet of Lockets or Strepsils. I'm sure he'd appreciate that very much. So Peter will be back next week, all being well. Thanks once again to Steve for giving Pete the week off.
Absolutely, anytime.
And on that bombshell,
I've been Steve.
And I've been David. We'll see you again soon on
The Earth 2 Podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.